This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. The Antichrist by Friedrich Nietzsche. Translated by H.L. Mencken. Section 1. Let us look each other in the face. We are Hyperboreans. We know well enough how remote our place is. Neither by land nor by water will you find the road to the Hyperboreans. Even Pindar in his day knew that much about us. Footnote. Confer the 10th Pythian Ode. See also the 4th book of Herodotus. The Hyperboreans were a mythical people beyond the Ripaean mountains in the far north. They enjoyed unbroken happiness and perpetual youth. End footnote. Beyond the north, beyond the ice, beyond death, our life, our happiness. We have discovered that happiness. We know the way. We got our knowledge of it from thousands of years in the labyrinth. Who else has found it? The man of today? I don't know either the way out or the way in. I am whatever doesn't know either the way out or the way in, so sighs the man of today. This is the sort of modernity that made us ill. We sickened on lazy peace, cowardly compromise, the whole virtuous dirtiness of the modern yea and nay. This tolerance and largeur of the heart that forgives everything because it understands everything is a sirocco to us. Rather live amid the ice than among modern virtues and other such south winds. We were brave enough. We spared neither ourselves nor others. But we were a long time finding out where to direct our courage. We grew dismal. They called us fatalists. Our fate, it was the fullness, the tension, the storing up of powers. We thirsted for the lightnings and great deeds. We kept as far as possible from the happiness of the weakling, from resignation. There was thunder in our air. Nature, as we embodied it, became overcast, for we had not yet found the way. The formula of our happiness, a yea, a nay, a straight line, a goal. Section 2. What is good? Whatever augments the feeling of power, the will to power, power itself in man. What is evil? Whatever springs from weakness. What is happiness? The feeling that power increases, that resistance is overcome. Not contentment, but more power. Not peace at any price, but war. Not virtue, but efficiency. Virtue in the Renaissance sense. Virtue, free of moral acid. The weak and the botched shall perish. First principle of our charity. And one should help them to it. What is more harmful than any vice? Practical sympathy for the botched and the weak, Christianity. Section 3. The problem that I set here is not what shall replace mankind in the order of living creatures. Man is an end. But what type of man must be bred, must be willed as being the most valuable, the most worthy of life, the most secure guarantee of the future? This more valuable type has appeared often enough in the past, but always as a happy accident, as an exception, never as deliberately willed. Very often, it has been precisely the most feared. Hitherto, it has been almost the terror of terrors. And out of that terror, the contrary type has been willed, cultivated, and attained. The domestic animal, the herd animal, the sick brute man, the Christian. Section 4. Mankind surely does not represent an evolution towards a better or stronger or higher level, as progress is now understood. This progress is merely a modern idea, which is to say, a false idea. The European of today and his essential worth falls far below the European of the Renaissance. The process of evolution does not necessarily mean elevation, enhancing, strengthening. True enough. It succeeds in isolated and individual cases in various parts of the earth and under the most widely different cultures. And in these cases, a higher type certainly manifests itself, something which, compared to mankind in the mass, appears as a sort of Superman. Such happy strokes of high success have always been possible, and will remain possible, perhaps, for all time to come. Even whole races, tribes, and nations may occasionally represent such lucky accidents. Section 5. We should not deck out and embellish Christianity. It has waged a war to the death against this higher type of man. It has put all the deepest instincts of this type under its ban. It has developed its concept of evil, of the evil one himself, out of these instincts. The strong man is the typical reprobate, the outcast among men. Christianity has taken the part of all the weak, the low, the botched. It has made an ideal out of antagonism to all the self-preservative instincts of sound life. It has corrupted even the faculties of those natures that are intellectually most vigorous by representing the highest intellectual values as sinful, as misleading, as full of temptation. The most lamentable example, the corruption of Pascal, who believed that his intellect had been destroyed by original sin, whereas it was actually destroyed by Christianity. Section 6. It is a painful and tragic spectacle that rises before me. I have drawn back the curtain from the rottenness of man. This word, in my mouth, is at least free from one suspicion that it involves a moral accusation against humanity. It is used, and I wish to emphasize the fact again, without any moral significance. And this is so far true that the rottenness I speak of is most apparent to me precisely in those quarters where there has been most aspiration hitherto toward virtue and godliness. As you probably surmise, I understand rottenness in the sense of décadence. My argument is that all the values on which mankind now fixes its highest aspirations are décadence values. I call an animal, a species, an individual, corrupt, when it loses its instincts, when it chooses, when it prefers what is injurious to it. A history of the higher feelings, the ideals of humanity, and it is possible that I'll have to write it, would almost explain why man is so degenerate. Life itself appears to me as an instinct for growth, for survival, for the accumulation of forces, for power. Whenever the will to power fails, there is disaster. My contention is that all the highest values of humanity have been emptied of this will, that the values of décadence, of nihilism, now prevail under the holiest names. Section 7. Christianity is called the religion of pity. Pity stands in opposition to all the tonic passions that augment the energy of the feeling of aliveness. It is a depressant. A man loses power when he pities. Through pity, that drain upon strength which suffering works is multiplied a thousandfold. Suffering is made contagious by pity. Under certain circumstances, it may lead to a total sacrifice of life and living energy, a loss out of all proportion to the magnitude of the cause, the case of the death of the Nazarene. This is the first view of it. There is, however, a still more important one. If one measures the effects of pity by the gravity of the reactions it sets up, its character as a menace to life appears in a much clearer light. Pity thwarts the whole law of evolution, which is the law of natural selection. It preserves whatever is ripe for destruction. It fights on the side of those disinherited and condemned by life. By maintaining life in so many of the botched of all kinds, it gives life itself a gloomy and dubious aspect. Mankind has ventured to call pity a virtue. In every superior moral system, it appears as a weakness. Going still further, it has been called the virtue, the source and foundation of all other virtues. But let us always bear in mind that this was from the standpoint of a philosophy that was nihilistic, and upon whose shield the denial of life was inscribed. Schopenhauer was right in this, that by means of pity, life is denied and made worthy of denial. Pity is the technique of nihilism. Let me repeat. This depressing and contagious instinct stands against all those instincts which work for the preservation and enhancement of life. In the role of protector of the miserable, it is a prime agent in the promotion of decadence. Pity persuades to extinction. Of course, one doesn't say extinction, one says the other world, or God, or the true life, or nirvana, salvation, blessedness. This innocent rhetoric from the realm of religious ethical balderdash appears a good deal less innocent when one reflects upon the tendency that it conceals beneath sublime words, the tendency to destroy life. Schopenhauer was hostile to life, that is why pity appeared to him as a virtue. Aristotle, as everyone knows, saw in pity a sickly and dangerous state of mind, the remedy for which was an occasional purgative. He regarded tragedy as that purgative. The instinct of life should prompt us to seek some means of puncturing any such pathological and dangerous accumulation of pity as that appearing in Schopenhauer's case, and also a lack, that of our whole literary decadence from St. Petersburg to Paris, from Tolstoy to Wagner, that it may be burst and discharged. Nothing is more unhealthy amid all our unhealthy modernism than Christian pity. To be the doctors here, to be unmerciful here, to wield the knife here. All this is our business. All this is our sort of humanity. By this sign, we are philosophers, we Hyperboreans. Section 8. It is necessary to say just whom we regard as our antagonists, theologians, and all who have any theological blood in their veins. This is our whole philosophy. One must have faced that menace at close hand. Better still, one must have had experience of it directly and almost succumbed to it, to realize that it is not to be taken lightly. The alleged free thinking of our naturalists and physiologists seems to me to be a joke. They have no passion about such things. They have not suffered. This poisoning goes a great deal further than most people think. I find the arrogant habit of the theologian among all who regard themselves as idealists, among all who, by virtue of a higher point of departure, claim a right to rise above reality and to look upon it with suspicion. The idealist, like the ecclesiastic, carries all sorts of lofty concepts in his hand, and not only in his hand. He launches them with benevolent contempt against understanding, the senses, honor, good living, science. He sees such things as beneath him, as pernicious and seductive forces, on which the soul soars as a pure thing in itself, as if humility, chastity, poverty, in a word, holiness, had not already done much more damage to life than all imaginable horrors and vices. The pure soul is a pure lie, so long as the priest, that professional denier, calumniator, and poisoner of life, is accepted as a higher variety of man. There can be no answer to the question, what is truth? Truth has already been stood on its head when the obvious attorney of mere emptiness is mistaken for its representative. Section 9. Upon this theological instinct I make war. I find the tracks of it everywhere. Whoever has theological blood in his veins is shifty and dishonorable in all things. The pathetic thing that grows out of this condition is called faith. In other words, closing one's eyes upon oneself once for all, to avoid suffering the sight of incurable falsehood. People erect concept of morality, of virtue, of holiness, upon this false view of all things. They ground good conscience upon faulty vision. They argue that no other sort of vision has value any more, once they have made theirs sacrosanct with the names of God, salvation, and eternity. I unearth this theological instinct in all directions. It is the most widespread and the most subterranean form of falsehood to be found on earth. Whatever a theologian regards as true must be false. There, you have almost a criterion of truth. His profound instinct of self-preservation stands against truth ever coming into honor in any way, or even getting stated. Wherever the influence of theologians is felt, there is a transvaluation of values, and the concepts, true and false, are forced to change places. Whatever is most damaging to life is there called true, and whatever exalts it, intensifies it, approves it, justifies it, and makes it triumphant is there called false. When theologians, working through the consciences of princes or of peoples, stretch out their hands for power, there is never any doubt as to the fundamental issue, the will to make an end. The nihilistic will exerts that power. Section 10. Among Germans, I am immediately understood when I say that theological blood is the ruin of philosophy. The Protestant pastor is the grandfather of German philosophy. Protestantism itself is its peccatum originale. Definition of Protestantism: hemiplegic paralysis of Christianity and of reason. One need only utter the words Tübingen school to get an understanding of what German philosophy is at bottom, a very artful form of theology. The Swabians are the best liars in Germany. They lie innocently. Why all the rejoicing over the appearance of Kant that went through the learned world of Germany, three-fourths of which is made up of the sons of preachers and teachers? Why the German conviction still echoing that with Kant came a change for the better? The theological instinct of German scholars made them see clearly just what had become possible again. A back stairs leading to the old ideal stood open. The concept of the true world, the concept of morality, is the essence of the world. The two most vicious errors that ever existed were once more, thanks to a subtle and wily skepticism, if not actually demonstrable, then at least no longer refutable. Reason, the prerogative of reason, does not go so far. Out of reality, there had been made appearance, an absolutely false world. That of being had been turned into reality. The success of Kant is merely a theological success. He was, like Luther and Leibniz, but one more impediment to German integrity, already far from steady. Section 11. A word now against Kant as a moralist. A virtue must be our invention. It must spring out of our personal need and defense. In every other case, it is a source of danger. That which does not belong to our life menaces it. A virtue which has its roots in mere respect for the concept of virtue, as Kant would have it, is pernicious. Virtue, duty, good for its own sake, goodness grounded upon impersonality or a notion of universal validity, these are all chimeras. And in them, one finds only an expression of the decay, the last collapse of life, the Chinese spirit of Königsberg. Quite the contrary is demanded by the most profound laws of self-preservation and of growth, to wit, that every man find his own virtue, his own categorical imperative. A nation goes to pieces when it confounds its duty with the general concept of duty. Nothing works a more complete and penetrating disaster than every impersonal duty, every sacrifice before the Moloch of abstraction. To think that no one has thought of Kant's categorical imperative as dangerous to life. The theological instinct alone took it under protection. An action prompted by the life instinct proves that it is a right action by the amount of pleasure that goes with it. And yet, that nihilist, with his bowels of Christian dogmatism, regarded pleasure as an objection. What destroys a man more quickly than to work, think, and feel without inner necessity, without any deep personal desire, without pleasure, as a mere automaton of duty? That is the recipe for decadence, and no less for idiocy. Kant became an idiot. And such a man was the contemporary of Goethe, this calamitous spinner of cobwebs, passed for the German philosopher, still passes today. I forbid myself to say what I think of the Germans. Didn't Kant see in the French Revolution the transformation of the state from the inorganic form to the organic? Didn't he ask himself if there was a single event that could be explained, save on the assumption of a moral faculty in man, so that, on the basis of it, the tendency of mankind towards the good could be explained once and for all time? Kant's answer? That is revolution. Instinct at fault in everything and anything. Instinct as a revolt against nature. German décadence as a philosophy. That is Kant. Section 12. I put aside a few skeptics, the types of decency in the history of philosophy. The rest haven't the slightest conception of intellectual integrity. They behave like women. All these great enthusiasts and prodigies, they regard beautiful feelings as arguments, the heaving breast as the bellows of divine inspiration, conviction as the criterion of truth. In the end, with German innocence, Kant tried to give a scientific flavor to this form of corruption, this dearth of intellectual conscience, by calling it practical reason. He deliberately invented a variety of reasons for use on occasions when it was desirable not to trouble with reason, that is, when morality, when the sublime command, thou shalt, was heard. When one recalls the fact that, among all peoples, the philosopher is no more than a development from the old type of priest, this inheritance from the priest, this fraud upon self, ceases to be remarkable. When a man feels that he has a divine mission, say, to lift up, to save, or to liberate mankind, when a man feels the divine spark in his heart and believes that he is the mouthpiece of supernatural imperatives, when such a mission inflames him, it is only natural that he should stand beyond all merely reasonable standards of judgment. He feels that he is himself sanctified by this mission, that he is himself a type of a higher order. What has a priest to do with philosophy? He stands far above it. And hitherto, the priest has ruled. He has determined the meaning of true and not true. Section 13. Let us not underestimate this fact that we ourselves, we free spirits, are already a transvaluation of all values, a visualized declaration of war and victory against all the old concepts of true and not true. The most valuable intuitions are the last to be attained. The most valuable of all are those which determine methods. All the methods, all the principles of the scientific spirit of today were the targets for thousands of years of the most profound contempt. If a man inclined to them, he was excluded from the society of decent people. He passed as an enemy of God, as a scoffer at the truth, as one possessed. As a man of science, he belonged to the Chandala, footnote, the lowest of the Hindu castes, and footnote. We have had the whole pathetic stupidity of mankind against us. their every notion of what the truth ought to be, of what the service of the truth ought to be, their every thou shalt was launched against us. Our objectives, our methods, our quiet, cautious, distrustful manner all appeared to them as absolutely discreditable and contemptible. Looking back, one may almost ask oneself with reason if it was not actually an aesthetic sense that kept men blind for so long. What they demanded of the truth was picturesque effectiveness, and of the learned, a strong appeal to their senses. It was our modesty that stood out longest against their taste. How well they guessed that, these turkey cocks of God. Section 14. We have unlearned something. We have become more modest in every way. We no longer derive man from the spirit, from the Godhead. We have dropped him back among the beasts. We regard him as the strongest of the beasts, because he is the craftiest. One of the results thereof is his intellectuality. On the other hand, we guard ourselves against a conceit which would assert itself even here, that man is the great second thought in the process of organic evolution. He is, in truth, anything but the crown of creation. Beside him stand many other animals, all at similar stages of development. And even when we say that, we say a bit too much, for man, relatively speaking, is the most botched of all the animals and the sickliest, and he has wandered the most dangerously from his instincts. Though for all that, to be sure, he remains the most interesting. As regards the lower animals, it was Descartes who first had the really admirable daring to describe them as machina. The whole of our physiology is directed towards proving the truth of this doctrine. Moreover, it is illogical to set man apart as Descartes did. What we know of man today is limited precisely by the extent to which we have regarded him too as a machine. Formerly, we accorded to man, as his inheritance from some higher order of beings, what was called free will. Now, we have taken even this will from him, for the term no longer describes anything that we can understand. The old word will now connotes only a sort of result, an individual reaction, that follows inevitably upon a series of partly discordant and partly harmonious stimuli. The will no longer acts or moves. Formerly, it was thought that man's consciousness, his spirit, offered evidence of his high origin, his divinity. That he might be perfected, he was advised, tortoise-like, to draw his senses in, to have no traffic with earthly things, to shuffle off his mortal coil. Then only the important part of him, the pure spirit, would remain. Here again, we have thought out the thing better. To us, consciousness, or the spirit, appears as a symptom of a relative imperfection of the organism, as an experiment, a groping, a misunderstanding, as an affliction which uses up nervous force unnecessarily. We deny that anything can be done perfectly so long as it is done consciously. The pure spirit is a piece of pure stupidity. Take away the nervous system and the senses, the so-called mortal shell, and the rest is miscalculation. That is all. Section 15. Under Christianity, neither morality nor religion has any point of contact with actuality. It offers purely imaginary causes, God, soul, ego, spirit, free will, or even unfree. And purely imaginary effects, sin, salvation, grace, punishment, forgiveness of sins. Intercourse between imaginary beings, God, spirits, souls, and imaginary natural history, anthropocentric, a total denial of the concept of natural causes, and imaginary psychology, misunderstandings of self, misinterpretations of agreeable or disagreeable general feelings, for example, of the states of the nervous sympathicus, with the help of the sign language of religio-ethical balderdash, repentance, pangs of conscience, temptation by the devil, the presence of God, an imaginary teleology, the kingdom of God, the last judgment, eternal life. This purely fictitious world, greatly to its disadvantage, is to be differentiated from the world of dreams. The latter, at least, reflects reality, whereas the former falsifies it, cheapens it, and denies it. Once the concept of nature had been opposed to the concept of God, the word natural necessarily took on the meaning of abominable. The whole of that fictitious world has its sources in hatred of the natural, the real, and is no more than evidence of a profound uneasiness in the presence of reality. This explains everything. Who alone has any reason for living his way out of reality? The man who suffers under it. But to suffer from reality, one must be a botched reality. The preponderance of pains over pleasures is the cause of this fictitious morality and religion. But such a preponderance also supplies the formula for decadence. Section 16. A criticism of the Christian concept of God leads inevitably to the same conclusion. A nation that still believes in itself holds fast to its own God. In him it does honor to the conditions which enable it to survive, to its virtues. It projects its joy in itself, its feeling of power, into a being to whom one may offer thanks. He who is rich will give of his riches. A proud people need a God to whom they can make sacrifices. Religion, within these limits, is a form of gratitude. A man is grateful for his own existence. To that end, he needs a God. Such a God must be able to work both benefits and injuries. He must be able to play either friend or foe. He is wondered at for the good he does, as well as for the evil he does. But the castration against all nature of such a God, making him a God of goodness alone, would be contrary to human inclination. Mankind has just as much need for an evil God as for a good God. It doesn't have to thank mere tolerance and humanitarianism for its own existence. What would be the value of a God who knew nothing of anger, revenge, envy, scorn, cunning, violence? Who would perhaps never experience the rapturous ardeurs of victory and of destruction? No one would understand such a God. Why should anyone want him? True enough, when a nation is on the downward path, when it feels its belief in its own future, its hope of freedom slipping from it, when it begins to see submission as a first necessity, and the virtues of submission as measures of self-preservation, then it must overhaul its God. He then becomes a hypocrite, timorous and demure. He counsels peace of soul, hate no more, leniency, love of friend and foe. He moralizes endlessly. He creeps into every private virtue. He becomes the God of every man. He becomes a private citizen, a cosmopolitan. Formerly, he represented a people, the strength of a people, everything aggressive and thirsty for power and the soul of a people. Now he is simply the good God. The truth is that there is no other alternative for gods. Either they are the will to power, in which case they are national gods, or incapacity for power, in which case they have to be good. Section 17. Wherever the will to power begins to decline, in whatever form, there is always an accompanying decline physiologically, a decadence. The divinity of this decadence, shorn of its masculine virtues and passions, is converted perforce into a god of the physiologically degraded, of the weak. Of course, they do not call themselves the weak, they call themselves the good. No hint is needed to indicate the moments in history at which the dualistic fiction of a good and an evil god first became possible. The same instinct which prompts the inferior to reduce their own god to goodness in itself also prompts them to eliminate all good qualities from the god of their superiors. They make revenge on their masters by making a devil of the latter's god, the good god, and the devil like him, are both abortions of decadence. How can we be so tolerant of the naivete of Christian theologians as to join in their doctrine that the evolution of the concept of God, from the God of Israel, the God of a people, to the Christian God, the essence of all goodness, is to be described as progress? But even Renan does this, as if Renan had a right to be so naive. The contrary actually stares one in the face. When everything necessary to ascending life, when all that is strong, courageous, masterful, and proud has been eliminated from the concept of God, when he has sunk step by step to the level of a staff for the weary, a sheet anchor for the drowning, when he becomes the poor man's God, the sinner's God, the invalid's God par excellence, and the attribute of Savior or Redeemer remains as the one essential attribute of divinity, just what is the significance of such a metamorphosis? What does such a reduction of the Godhead imply? To be sure, the kingdom of God has thus grown larger. Formerly, he had only his own people, his chosen people. But since then, he has gone wandering, like his people themselves, into foreign parts. He has given up settling down quietly anywhere. Finally, he has come to feel at home everywhere, and is the great cosmopolitan. Until now, he has the great majority on his side, and half the earth. But this god of the great majority, this democrat among gods, has not become a proud heathen god. On the contrary, he remains a Jew. He remains a god in a corner, a god of all the dark nooks and crevices, of all the noisome quarters of the world. His earthly kingdom, now as always, is a kingdom of the underworld, a souterrain kingdom, a ghetto kingdom. And he himself is so pale, so weak, so decadent. Even the palest of the pale are able to master him, messieurs, the metaphysicians, those albinos of the intellect. They spun their webs around him for so long that finally he was hypnotized, and began to spin himself, and became another metaphysician. Thereafter, he resumed once more his old business of spinning the world out of his inmost being, subspecies Spinoza. Thereafter, he became ever thinner and paler, became the ideal, became pure spirit, became the absolute, became the thing in itself. The collapse of a god, he became a thing in itself. Section 18. The Christian concept of a god, the god as the patron of the sick, the god as a spinner of cobwebs, the god as a spirit, is one of the most corrupt concepts that has ever been set up in the world. It probably touches low watermark in the ebbing evolution of the god type. God degenerated into the contradiction of life, instead of being its transfiguration and eternal yea. In him, war is declared on life, on nature, on the will to live. God becomes the formula for every slander upon the here and now, and for every lie about the beyond. In him, nothingness is deified, and the will to nothingness is made holy. Section 19. The fact that the strong races of Northern Europe did not repudiate this Christian God does little credit to their gift for religion, and not much more to their taste. They ought to have been able to make an end of such moribund and worn-out product of the décadence. A curse lies upon them because they were not equal to it. They made illness, decrepitude, and contradiction a part of their instincts. And since then, they've not managed to create any more gods. 2,000 years have come and gone, and not a single new god. Instead, there still exists, and as if by some intrinsic right, as if he were the ultimatum and maximum of the power to create gods, of the creator spiritus in mankind, this pitiful god of Christian monotheism, this hybrid image of decay conjured up out of emptiness, contradiction, and vain imagining, in which all the instincts of décadence, all the cowardices and wearinesses of the soul find their sanction. End sections 1 through 19. This recording is in the public domain.